Welcome to the 100th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
When we reached our 50, we had as many half centuries as Glenn McGrath. Now, we're the podcast that scored more centuries than Shane Warne.
And we're bringing up our ton in style today, an inimitable Reverse Threat Radio style. Andy's going to be looking at the history of that dismissal, that old dismissal, timed out. We're going to be reviewing Duncan Hamilton's The Kings of Summer about the 2016 County Championship coming down to the wire. And then at the end of the podcast, we have a rather special moment when a couple of weeks ago I got to sit on the boundary of the Junction Oval in Melbourne with none other than the cricket writer Gideon Haigh. I must confess, I have rarely been so nervous in my entire life, but you can listen to that interview at the very end of the podcast. But before we kick off, now, cricket is, of course, a proudly statistical sport, and so we've been going back and looking at our, analysing our performance. That's the way you improve, isn't it? You analyse your performance. We've been looking at our wagon wheel and our averages. Our first episode happened on the 13th of October 2010, and our first 50 episodes took us 1,045 days at an average of one episode every 3 weeks, which you were quite impressed by, Andy, I think.
It was.
It
did show that in our podcasting youth, we were sort of ruthlessly efficient, weren't we? Because we were the kind of like young batsmen sort of churning out with an impressive strike rate. But then everything slowed down a little.
Everything slowed down. So those first 50 episodes, we were at some outgrounds, I think, in Brixton, in Baker Street, and in Cambridge was mainly where that happened. During our second 50, we went international, actually. So Reverse Threat Radio 55 onwards was recorded with myself in Australia, and Andy now in Paris as of a couple of episodes ago as well. So we slowed down a little bit. Our second 50 took us 1,645 days, which is an episode, which is an average of 32.9 days per episode.
So at a current trend, we will expect to get to episode 150, you know, 40 years time or something. So, you know, we'd all be very
Indeed.
Grateful if you could hang on till then.
So 7 years, 4 months since we kicked off this podcast. We know that there are people who have been with us from the very beginning, which is both terrifying and incredibly flattering. So thank you to those people, and also thank you to the people who have joined us along the way as well. Now let's get down to the cricket. Some news that I think broke today around Virat Kohli coming to England potentially to play ahead of the India series, which had you quite excited, Andy.
Well, I think this is fantastic news both for the County Championship and for Test cricket as a whole. I got the chance to see the Indian team when they were touring a few years ago play against Middlesex in a just touring tour match. And the fuss and the sort of brouhaha around, it was brilliant to see. And you can imagine, I mean, Virat Kohli is the probably most high-profile sports cricketer in the world right now.
He is the superstar, yeah.
He is the superstar, and he will be bringing that to the County Championship. You know, who knows? He will be bringing it to sort of all corners of the County Championship. We don't know as yet which team he'll be turning out for, but I think Surrey has seen as sort of early favourites. But I think, you know, let's remember, if he gets a few games in, you know, not just whoever he plays for, but whoever he plays against will benefit from that interest, those increased crowds. But also, let's remember, this is a great show of faith in Test cricket, because
exactly, he could have just been carried on playing in India, but actually setting the time aside to play county cricket in the UK. And to play within that format is no small consideration from his point of view.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we are all getting quite obsessed with now in terms of some of the least successful test series is lack of preparation. So, you know, England being bowled out for 58 at the start of this week, you know, a lot of people putting that down to a failure to take preparation seriously. And we've seen that in other examples where test teams just do not give themselves the proper chance to acclimatise to conditions. Virat Kohli is making a clear statement here that he wants to go to India and do well. He wants to go to England and do well, and he wants his India team to win abroad there. And I think we often talk about in this podcast the importance of what India thinks and what India reckons about the game. And it's a great show of confidence in Test cricket from Kohli and the Indian team as a whole. I think there's
it goes
also
back, it, So I was going to say it goes back a little bit to that back in the day when you would have the Lancashire League and players coming from around the world to come and compete, and that just made an absolutely thriving cricket hub in England. Now, clearly, Virat Kohli in and of himself isn't creating that, but it harks back a little bit to that time when that was the case, when people wanted to come and be a part of English county cricket.
Absolutely. I mean, you're also rather hilariously, any story like this does also get going the very boring old debate about should counties be helping an enemy player? You know, we have this every time there's an Ashes in England and a few Australians come over earlier. And I think we're at a stage now where we've got to think about the good of the sport as a whole, really. And, you know, this is all part of the same problem where, you know, a touring test team plays a couple of warm-ups and the host gives them some dreadful opposition to play against. And as a result, they go into the series undercooked. And we've got to look beyond that. We've got to say, you know, the little advantage we can gain as a country by screwing up another team's test preparations are just not worth it in the context of the game as a whole. So I would hope that I've already seen some stuff on social media about saying, oh, that would be, you know, great. We're helping the Indian captain. I think we've got to look a little bit bigger than that. Now, Kohli is one development. There has been another development in the cricketing world that has, I mean, it's quite something when cricket is kind of on the front page of the BBC News website. And when it is, it rarely tends to be for good reasons.
No, and you know, we as cricket fans, we get passionate about our sport, and we get involved with, you know, on a whole number of levels, all the way through from, you know, when you listen to Geoffrey Boycott commentating and he's, you know, in uproar about the standard of the players, all the way through to the indignation that happened when England were, as you referred to, bowled out for 58 or whatever it was last week against New Zealand. But none of this compares to obviously what's broken today with the ball tampering story with Cameron Bancroft and his bit of sticky tape down in South Africa when playing for the Australian Test side. The first thing that, you know, the moment that this story was broken to me, which I think is quite telling actually, is that I was lying in bed this morning. It was Saturday night last night. I had a reasonably, you know, heavy night. It was 8 o'clock this morning, and my girlfriend came and woke me up, and she said, "Oh, Cameron Bancroft has been accused of ball tampering." Now, my partner does not know anything about cricket and really does not care, and I think usually gets quite bored of my talking about it. But immediately there was this real sense that this was something quite significant. And as the stories developed throughout the day here in Australia, it's been absolutely huge. You know, the Prime Minister has weighed in using phrases like, you know, beggar's belief and shocked and stuff like that. The governmental Australian Sports Commission has called for Smith to be stood down. A whole number of ex-players and commentators have come out and said similar things. Now, obviously, this is a developing story, and just a couple of minutes ago, we saw that Smith had been stood down from the position of captain for the rest of this test match. But what I think is interesting about this initial reaction is that even in a day and age when we have a really kind of hyped up media industry, and even when we've been through a few years when cricket has tended towards a sensationalist, and 2020 has helped that, you know, the fact that we've had spot fixing scandals has helped that. The fact, frankly, that tragically cricketers have died on the pitch have kind of helped that along. But yet we still, as a cricketing fraternity, get up in arms about things that we see to be a breach of this, you know, this thing called the spirit of cricket in inverted commas.
I think there has been a lot of schadenfreude, not surprisingly, from non-Australian fans who are saying this proves what we've said for a long time, that Australia fundamentally play the game in a less positive spirit, frankly, than everyone else. There's been a lot of chunter about this line. You know, every time there is an incident, Australians seem to talk about this magic line and never going beyond the line. But I think it's worth noting, however smug some of us are feeling at the moment, that this taints the game rather than just one team. You know, I'd give the example of something like cycling, and I know it's slightly different, and you talk about the
Exactly,
drug
yeah.
scandals in that. At the end of the day, everyone suffers, the whole sport suffers. And this is the same here. You know, however smug we're feeling about the state of the Australian team and the way they've behaved, ultimately, Test cricket as a whole will lose out from this.
But certainly, compared to something like cycling, where everyone is so jaded that when a whole lot of new revelations come out, there's a kind of a bit of sense of inevitability about it. I kind of take a bit of comfort in the fact that there is so much uproar around this. There is so much uproar of someone trying to rub a bit of hard soil into one side of the game. I think that actually, in a way, speaks volumes about the care that we have for cricket, that when someone does step over the line, that this is the reaction to it.
There is a premeditation to it, which I think is causing a lot of upset. So this has already been a tasty series, to put it politely. I mean, it's been fantastic in terms of cricketing, what I've been able to follow between Australia and South Africa. But there have been incident after incident, which I won't be able to recount here, with Rabada, with Warner. There's been lots going on. But a lot of those things have been sort of crimes of passion. You know, someone loses their temper in the moment and they say something they shouldn't. We are, as a sport, you know, I think we obviously need to deal with those and think about those. They feel very different, though, to a senior leadership of a team sitting down and coming up with a plan to cheat and then seemingly coercing, or, you know, he's an adult, he can make his own decisions, but seemingly encouraging one of the more junior members in the team to carry it out. And I think that is clearly coming across particularly badly.
From the archives. Now, it's quite a frequent question in pub quizzes or trivia nights, as they're called on this side of the world. How many ways are there that you can be out in cricket? And one of the ones when people are asked to list them that people often forget about, because it very, very rarely actually ever happens, is timed out. And Andy is going to tell us about the history of this quirky little law of the game.
It's not asking very much of a cricketer to walk out to the middle when it's your turn to bat. But if you fail to do that, you put yourself at risk of what is the rarest of dismissals. Now, I actually discovered in researching this that the rules around this have changed. So a batsman used to have 2 minutes to make it onto the field of play. So onto the field of play means crossing the boundary rope. Now, if a batsman failed to do that, their whole team's innings would be deemed over on the grounds that they were refusing to bat. So it wasn't just the batsman who would go. That would be effectively a declaration of the innings. It was only in 1980 that the current law was introduced. Now, Law 40 says that if a batsman isn't in the middle within 3 minutes of the dismissal or retirement of the previous batsman, they will be timed out. So I don't know. You could argue, I guess, over which is more or less generous. You've got 2 minutes to get over the boundary rope, or 3 minutes to get to the middle. But the key difference
to the middle means ready to bat.
It
so
does
ready to face the ball.
That's
so you
absolutely
can't just be
right.
Loitering in the middle, putting your gloves on, and you know, that's, just having a chat.
That's absolutely right. So you, or of course the batsman at the other end, if you're not on strike, have to be ready to receive the ball within 3 minutes. So there is that difference, and I think you could dispute. It's not clear to me that one is more generous than the other. But the key difference is that since 1980, it will only be that batsman who is out. So that batsman will be timed out, but the team can continue with their innings. Whereas prior to 1980, that would be it. The innings would have been complete. So it's been 38 years since Law 40 was introduced, and there have only been 5 instances in that time of a timed out dismissal in first class cricket, and never one in test matches or ODIs. So it's the South African Andrew Jordan who holds the unique honour, I suppose we'll call it an honour, of being the first player in first class cricket to be dismissed timed out. He was playing for Eastern Province against Transvaal and finished the previous day not out. Now, there was torrential rain overnight, which apparently made the local roads impassable, although the other players seem to have made it there, so that's interesting. But Jordan couldn't make it to the ground for the start of play. The other thing I sort of find perplexing about this story is you have torrential rain, but apparently play started on time. So there's a few things about this story that don't fully add
don't
up
quite
to me.
Stack up.
So either Andrew Jordan was trying it on with his excuses, or this was some very localised rain. As a sort of statistical curiosity, his achievement, again, if we're going to call it that, wasn't recognised until 2006, because this match was played under the South African Cricket Board, which during apartheid governed cricket played by non-white South Africans. And prior to 2006, this wasn't recognised as first class. So Jordan kind of took that honour a long time after the original event. Now, transport woes crop up again again in another first-class timed-out dismissals. Vasbert Drakes, the West Indian, is actually the only Test player to have been dismissed time-out, although not in a Test match. It's September 2002, and he's supposed to be playing for Border against Free State in South Africa. He's just been playing for the West Indies in the Champions Trophy in Sri Lanka, but he says, no, I can make it. However, his flight is then severely delayed, so he never even makes it to the ground.
And it's an interesting distinction between sort of timed out, dismissed, and just weren't, players who weren't even at the game, which seems a bit harsh to actually sort of give them out. I mean, they're not really out, they're just not there.
Well, I think it's interesting that in both cases, so in Andrew Jordan's case, the match was underway and then he couldn't make the second day. In Vasbert Drakes' case, I guess that if they wanted to, Border could have withdrawn him from the starting 11 and played someone else. But I think presumably what they did is they said, oh, okay, he's a bowler. We want him to bowl later in the game when his plane does turn up, so we'll just accept the timed out. But I think I agree with you that I think the more interesting timed out dismissals are when the player was actually at the ground. So when they were somehow at the ground but never made it to the middle. So I'll take you back to December 1997 and Orissa and Tripura are contesting a Ranji Trophy match. Tripura lose their ninth wicket and the umpires call for drinks. But at the end of the drinks break, the Tripura number 11, Hemalal Yadav, has made no attempt to come on and he's just sitting on the boundary edge having a chat with his team manager. The Orissa fielders appeal and the umpires give Yadav out. Now, I really enjoy this story because presumably Yadav was just having a very good natter and I guess he was misled by the ongoing drinks break. So he presumably saw play had stopped and he felt he didn't need to rush. But credit,
When does the timing start? Does it start from the moment that the previous batsman is given out the moment the previous batsman leaves the field?
There's a good question. It starts from the moment they are dismissed. So from the moment in the case of a ordinary dismissal, from the moment the umpire's finger goes up, or from the moment, the moment the wickets are struck, not from the moment they leave the pitch. One that's interesting as well is something like a retirement, where it starts, my understanding is, from the moment they inform the umpire that they have retired. The drinks break, you can see, adds a confusion here, because the clock does start running during the drinks break. The drinks break doesn't stop the clock. And I don't know, you could have the usual debates about spirit of the game and stuff, but you sort of have to give the Orissa fielders some credit for their cunningness here, that obviously they were aware during the drinks break that the clock was running and that they took advantage and got Yadav out. Now, Andrew Harris had a slightly better excuse than Yadav. He was playing for Nottinghamshire against Durham University back in 2003 and he had a strained groin muscle and he wasn't going to bat. But Chris Reid was nearing 100, and as you do if you're nearing 100 in a first class game, even if you're just beating up a load of students, he wanted his tail enders to come out and help him get to that 100. Now, so Harris was padding up, his runner was getting ready. Now, the number 10 before Harris went out and got out very, very quickly. So poor old Harris is hobbling down the pavilion steps, only to find the players coming off. And Reid, interestingly, stranded, not out on 94. Harris claimed that no one appealed, but he was given out nonetheless, although other accounts suggest that the Durham players did indeed appeal. By this stage, Nottinghamshire had racked up 542, so you could forgive the Durham students for wanting to get things over with by this point. The most recent of the first-class timed-out dismissals is actually the one I've been able to find out the least about. So Ryan Austin was timed out playing for combined campuses and colleges against the Windward Islands in 2014. The only thing I have been able to find out is that Austin finished this game as the man of the match with 11 wickets. So perhaps he felt he'd done enough with the ball to not bother turning out to bat.
What's interesting about all of these is that they are all slightly farcical. So there is not a single situation where it's not a kind of honest mistake that couldn't have been rectified by the umpire. I mean, other than the first two where the player wasn't even on the ground. But they couldn't have been rectified by the umpire saying, come on, hurry up, you need to be out in the middle. You know, that would have rectified all of the other ones. That it's never a case of, you know, it's on the last day and there's fading light and the batsmen are just desperately trying to wind down the clock as long as they can. And so it's odd as a rule that it seems to sort of just prey on misfortune rather than actually, you know, provide anything useful, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's a very good point. I mean, I think with Harris, you get the sense that because this was, you know, it was one of those pre-season warm-up games, basically, even though they are first-class games against the universities. And you can imagine the situation. It's 542 for nine. The umpires know, presumably, that Harris is injured, so they may not have even been certain that he was coming out to bat. And they presumably say, oh, you know, let's get this over with. I think the Ranji Trophy example seems like the only one to me where you think maybe there was a little bit of kind of conscious strategy involved. Your point about time wasting is one that I found very intriguing, sort of looking this up, is that you would think for a team looking to save a game, it would make sense to push this, right? So you would think if you're trying to save a game, surely you would take 2 minutes and 59 seconds to be out there.
Yep.
I haven't come across examples of that, but it would be interesting to know if they exist. I said at the start of this feature that no player has ever been timed out in a test match, but it did nearly happen. So I'll take you back to South Africa versus India, Cape Town, January 2007. And India, as is often the case in South Africa, are not having a great time of it. Sehwag and Wasim Jaffa go quickly, and it should have been the great Sachin Tendulkar in next. However, Tendulkar had been off the field for a time when India were fielding in the preceding innings. And the rule on this is, and I think is still the rule now, that whatever time you're off for over a certain period of time, you're then not allowed back on the field during that time. So he wasn't allowed out until 10:48, and it was still prior to that time. So poor old Sourav Ganguly has to get frantically padded up. It's interesting about umpire common sense here, because Daryl Harper takes the decision to inform Graham Smith that the delay is a result of unforeseen circumstances, not a deliberate tactic. In the spirit of the game, he requests Smith not to appeal. Smith agrees, but it's kind of interesting here because India have screwed that up. You know, it's not an unknown rule. They probably should have anticipated. They probably should have just had more players padded up. So, you know, had Smith stuck to his guns and said, actually, I'd quite like to get an Indian player out, they'd have appealed. He could have appealed. There's another sort of lovely quirk to this, which is that we all forget that there is nothing formal about a batting order. So you don't have to submit a batting order in advance. No one needs it approved. You can change it when you want, which actually means, had Smith appealed, what India should sensibly have done is actually said that their number 11 was next in and that they were out. They would not have been actually under any pressure or any need to say, oh, you know, it's Sourav Ganguly that was out. So there was actually a bit of scope for manipulation on both sides.
I wonder what would happen if we got rid of this rule, if there wasn't a 3 minute regulation for batsmen to be in the middle, whether people would start pushing it, what the inevitable result would be. Presumably you need some kind of sanction in place, you know, a deduction of runs or something like that. But I suppose the other thing that's quite interesting about that last example you gave, the nearly timed out in the test match, is actually how kind of unnecessarily disappointing it would have been if, say, Tendulkar had actually been given timed out because there was a little bit of confusion. You know, is that actually something that's good for the game? I'd suggest that it probably isn't.
Well, I think giving Tendulkar out timed out would have, I mean, we all know the esteem he has held in within India. Oh, God, yeah, I think you would have been a brave, brave umpire to have done that. I think, as you say, it's a rule that is there as a necessity, and it is something that you, and as you can see with only five first class dismissals, it's something that really should always be avoided by common sense. Of course, 2020 has brought with it its own sort of take on timed out, where you only have 90 seconds to get to the middle, hence you have the players in their dugouts on the side. And I guess it's possible you could see a situation in the future where maybe that maps across to test cricket. Maybe you decide you want to speed the test game up even more and you bring 3 minutes down to 90 seconds.
The review, and for this episode, we have had the very great pleasure of reading Duncan Hamilton's The Kings of Summer, How Cricket's 2016 County Championship Came Down to the Very Last Match of the Season, which is a pretty snappy subtitle. Duncan Hamilton is, well, to put it bluntly, one of our favourite authors. In the on the fly of this book, it has the rather wonderful sentence about him. Like C.P. Snow, he regards drinking tea while watching a game of cricket as one of life's great pleasures. We've reviewed a couple of his other books on the podcast. His book on his extraordinary biography of Harold Larwood. And then A Last English Summer, that actually in the 50th episode of Reverse Web Radio, Andy identified as being his favourite cricket book that we'd reviewed up to that point. Now, Andy, you actually went to the game that this book describes. You came off a plane, you went to the last afternoon. Set the scene for us.
So it was an extraordinary ending. It was one of those things, again, that if you'd set up in some sort of sporting film, you wouldn't have believed. But effectively, the championship had come down to three teams: Middlesex, Yorkshire and Somerset. Middlesex and Yorkshire were playing at Lord's. Somerset, by the final day, had already beaten relegated Nottinghamshire. Somerset's players were waiting at the pavilion at Taunton and following the game, knowing that a draw at Lord's would make them county champions. Middlesex and Yorkshire were at a stage where, after a little bit of rain and a little bit of weather, they're in a position where they needed to contrive a result. They needed to come up with something. So you had a slightly funny stage on the last day, which involved Adam Lythe bowling some absolute filth for Yorkshire to help Middlesex set up a declaration score. And in the end, Middlesex set Yorkshire 240 to win off 40 overs. And I arrived with about 30 overs to go. And it was well worth Duncan Hamilton's attention as a game.
And do you think that this book lives up to that? Because it's often the case that, you know, writing about cricket can sometimes not quite capture the kind of real excitement of the moment. Do you feel, having been at the game, that this book actually added anything to your understanding of it?
I think at Hamilton, as just a cricket writer and as a sort of a recorder of matches and of an occasion, he's got it all. So he can do the technical insight. So, you know, all the best cricket writers leave you, as you say, I think, understanding the game better. So there's a wonderful bit in the book where he analyses the run-ups of the different bowlers, and it just leaves you thinking, ah, I've seen that 100 times, but I've never quite picked up on it. But really, you read Hamilton for the prose. I mean, he is just such a fine writer. I know it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but he does bring the occasion to life, and he makes a cricket game sound so much more than just a cricket game. It's a very you feel the kind of struggles of all the players involved. I'll just give you one line which stuck with me when he talks about Andrew Gale, Yorkshire's hopelessly out of form captain. Gale is a pugilist, a black eye and even a sock on the jaw never enough to stop him scrapping. It's that sort of stuff.
One of the things to add to that, that because we've seen those things in Hamilton's previous books as well, I think one thing that for me came out really strongly in this book was the suspense that he is able to build. It's always a bit of a challenge when you sort of know how things end to be able to bring them to life again. But there's one particular passage when Yorkshire, at the end of their first innings, need to get to a certain total in order to get a bonus point, which if they then win, the bonus point will tip them over the edge to actually getting the county championship. And so there's this little mini narrative that unfolds when Ryan Sidebottom and Tim Bresnan are batting and they have to get to a particular total. And I was lying in bed reading this and really should have been going to sleep, but I just could not put it down. And I actually felt, you know, that feeling in your stomach of kind of nervousness when I knew perfectly well how it ended. And it wasn't even who won the game or not. It was just, would their first inning score get to a particular point? And that's something I've never seen Hamilton do before, but is a real art, I think.
It's actually just on that specific point, it's a great advert for the bonus point system, which I know a lot of people who look at, and I must admit myself at times, say, God, this is a complicated, mad way of scoring things. But that moment, with Sidebottom and Bresnan scrapping their way to 350, which is the key bonus point that keeps them in the title race, is a great advert for it. I think you're absolutely right that this it's a short book. It's kind of almost novella length. is different to his previous work, there are common themes. So much as when he wrote The Last English Summer, this book is informed not just by a love of the game, but also a real fear for its future. And there is a passage where he looks around Lords and he describes his fear. He says he sees the age of many of the fans. He sees the empty seats. And his writing is clearly motivated by an anxiety and a need to kind of preserve the game at its best. I must admit, I don't quite share that level of pessimism, but I certainly do share his love for the game.
And that's a bit of a paradox in the book as well, because it's difficult to share that level of pessimism when you have such a brilliant advert for the game that this for the county championship that this particular match is. But then the wider narrative that he paints of the season and the way that the season has developed and the little sort of mini stories that have come around certain players and the progress of certain teams within that, you suddenly get really kind of engrossed in that whole world in quite a substantial way. And I think that's a great success of the book, actually, and that's one of the things that this book does, is to champion the championship.
And he does a lot more, doesn't he, than just focus on that season. I mean, how, in your view, how successful is he in linking it into the wider history of the game?
Well, he starts off with that wonderful description of how he would like to go to Lords as C.B. Fry, and then throughout the book there are references to his great hero, the cricket writer Neville Cardus, and in fact we were delighted to find out from this that Duncan Hamilton is currently writing a book on Neville Cardus, which you can be sure that we will be reviewing on this podcast at some point. But I thought he was actually quite, there is something quite sentimental about the way that he looks back at the past of the game. You know, he talks about things like, you know, the photos of Edwardian era photos of people milling around on the outfield during the game and being able to recreate that during this game, because it's the last game of the season, Lords let you onto the outfield. So there's something that's a little bit sort of rose-tinted about that. But there's also something, I think, that, and this is going to necessarily sound very naff, but there's something within that that actually points to the kind of eternal nature of cricket, and the fact that being a cricket fan and sitting and watching someone bowl and someone bat and someone field has actually changed very little over the years. That essential elemental nature of it just does not change.
And I think you get a lot here from the fact that Duncan Hamilton is not in the press box. He is watching this as a cricket supporter. And I think reading this, as I did, in a Paris that seems to be eternally cold at the moment, it really did sort of conjure up the summer wonderfully. He talks about the importance of routine. And he talks about, I love the small, comfortable rituals of match day. Buying a scorecard, even though modern scorecards make it unnecessary. The first cup of tea, the second, a slice of afternoon coffee cake, perhaps a rummage through the second-hand bookstore. And he sort of goes on in this vein, and it does make you realise that we all go to cricket for the cricket, but also we go for a lot more besides. There's a kind of life of the supporter that goes a lot beyond the game, and also that I think is always very hard to explain to anyone who isn't there, who doesn't follow it.
You briefly mentioned the fact that this book is quite short. It's in the edition that I have, it's 117 pages long, and it's easily readable at one sitting, which I think is perfect for this, because the narrative can then really gather pace and you can immerse yourself in it. The other thing is that too often you see people who are real enthusiasts write about something that they love, particularly in the cricket world, and because they're really enthusiastic, it just blows out and you have 400 pages and it's virtually impenetrable for someone who's a little bit detached from that. I'm thinking of nothing in particular other than that book on the ball that got hit for six and got lost, which is one of the most painful weeks of my life. Anyway, this one manages to keep up. It packs into those 110 pages, an astonishing narrative, and manages to sort of keep up the pace as well, I think.
That was The Kings of Summer by Duncan Hamilton, which comes with our strongest recommendations. To the interview, and for our 100th episode, we've got someone a little bit special. Gideon Hay may well be the great cricket writer of our times, and his work's given Toby, me, and many of our listeners a huge amount of pleasure. Toby and Gideon spoke while watching a Sheffield Shield game at the Junction Oval in Melbourne. It was a windy day, so the sound quality is not perfect throughout, but do persist through those parts because it is well worth it.
So I'm here at the Junction Oval in the seaside suburb of St Kilda. It's got a sort of bracing sea breeze. I'm watching penultimate day of the New South Wales Victoria match, and sitting next to me is none other than Gideon Hay. When I slunk out of some meetings, felt a little bit like Alan Ross as a schoolboy about to get a caning from the headmaster. But for you, Gideon, you've been watching cricket professionally for years now. Does this just feel like the day job coming here?
No, I feel like I'm skiving off from my normal day job. I'm down here because my friend Ed Cowan's playing the game, and I had dinner with him on Friday night, and I said I'd pop down at some stage during the match to have a look. Unfortunately, I didn't bring him luck because he's been stumped for six, but never mind. It's a beautiful day to watch a bit of cricket. Interesting, though, the two of the players out there, Chris Tremaine and Curtis Patterson, I interviewed a couple of years ago, so it's interesting to see them opposed. Two very interesting and thoughtful young cricketers whose careers I've watched with great interest since. So I guess, you know, there's a little personal dimension to my exposure to this game. But played cricket yesterday, played cricket the day before that. You know, an awful lot of my life is given over to cricket, and it never quite loses its novelty. And I guess I do feel a certain kinship for the players involved in this game, because ultimately it's the same game, it's played over the same distances, similar crowds, actually. And I probably relate quite easily to what these players are undergoing.
There are a lot of writers and commentators now who are ex-players. You have said quite adamantly that you do not feel that you would enjoy being a professional cricket player. Are there things, though, that you feel you miss out on as an analyst, as a writer, from not having had the experience of playing cricket at the highest level?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. It's there's no doubt. I mean, we can fool ourselves into thinking that we that there's something that we haven't missed out on, but I think it my own limited experience of dealing with players of the very top class is that they are different. They're sort of qualitatively different. I can't really put a finger on it, but they just talk about the game and they relate to the game in ways that I can only dream of. I mean, Ed's an interesting example. You know, Ed's a very good friend of mine. We've known each other for probably 10 years. He's very good company. He's a very articulate, well-spoken, interesting man. But he's just different. He's just a bit tougher, a bit more confident, a bit more poised, self-deprecating in the most charming way. But there is a core of kind of inner strength to him that reinforces his belief in his own ability. And that's something that I've just never had, and I've never had the reason for it.
And do you think the same reasons that you are... Well, there are some of the same reasons that mean that you are not a professional-level cricketer that mean that you are a professional-level writer?
I guess so. I mean, my cricket career has been a subject of sort of innocent merriment for most of my life.
For you and the opponents?
Yeah, but I also... I've contributed to lots of other people's happy memories.
Yes.
I guess if you went out there expecting success all the time, or you experienced too much success, perhaps you wouldn't see the sort of occasional melancholy undertone of the game. the same way as it does for me.
Talk about Ed Cowan being a friend. I believe that Michael Atherton is a close friend of yours as well. I mean, are you part of a kind of fraternity, as it were? And does that fraternity include cricketers as well as writers?
Well, I guess Groucho Marx said that he didn't want to be a member of any club that would accept him as a member. He's a very good friend. That's been undergirded by the fact that we both write about the game, but you know, our families are close and our interests are broad. And it's a slightly strange friendship in the sense that, you know, for the first sort of 15 years of our relationship, I only watched him play, and he didn't know that I existed. So it's got that undertone to it. But if you know Mike for any length of time, you realise that doesn't really matter to him very much. You know, he's a man who, when he stopped playing, stopped really thinking of himself as a player, and dedicated himself wholeheartedly to the pursuit of being the best writer that he could possibly be. Not every cricketer turned media professional has that same attitude, but it's one of the things that I find most admirable about Michael, and his consistent pursuit of excellence no matter what he's doing.
You say that you don't think of yourself as part of the sort of cricket writing fraternity, but yet you have written books on characters in cricket and on events in cricket that have been described, not by yourself, but by many others, as being canonical and definitive. I'm thinking particularly about things like World Series. I'm thinking about cricketers like Shane Warne. How does that sit with not being part of the fraternity?
Well, that's the book writing fraternity, and that's barely even a fraternity. You know, the proportion of people who write about cricket who go on to write books is vanishingly small. I've never known all that many of them myself. It's pretty hard to consider that to be a club. It's a pretty eccentric membership if it is a club. I've also written books about other things, and I consider myself to be just mainly a journalist who every so often, when the mood takes him, writes about cricket. I wouldn't want to be typecast as only writing about a sport. And the kind of the skills that I bring to it are journalistic. They're not cricketing. I just use part of the basic sort of journalistic toolkit that I've accumulated over 34 years, is it now, that I've been a print journalist, and hopefully I get a little bit better every year. I'd hate to think that it were otherwise. Otherwise, I'd be wasting my time.
So those are kind of, in your mind, they're two quite separate things, being a cricket journalist and writing for, you know, a piece for a daily, and writing your books. That's a kind of two different sides of what you do.
Well, I mean, insofar as I've had a career at all, it's been led entirely the wrong way around, in the sense that normally one starts as a daily print journalist and then turns to writing books. But I wrote my first cricket book long before I was a member of the cricketing press corps. That was back in 1992, when I sort of thought, well, I wouldn't mind turning my hand to writing a cricket book. I wonder what it should be about. Well, serious cricket's an interesting subject. Why don't I have a go at that and see if I can do it? I'd written one book before then. I'd written a business book in 1987, which hadn't entirely satisfied me. But I'd always thought that I wouldn't mind having a crack at cricket. I did learn a lot in the course of doing the cricket war about accumulating documentary material, interviewing cricketers, relating to cricketers. studying a period in its context, in its time and space, and also sort of correlating other people's recollections with my own, because one of the reasons why I wanted to concentrate on that period was because I could remember it myself. Now, I was a young cricket fan in 1977-78 who was both appalled in the manner of the youthful prude about these men who are playing for something
money
playing for something other than honour and glory, and yet at the same time kind of fascinated and excited by it at the same time, because all of a sudden in Australia there was cricket on both channels. So it was an important part of my upbringing. Cameron White bowling some pretty ropey leg breaks here. That one just ballooned off the pad to slip. My books were part of my audition for my daily journalism career. That's not the way it's meant to work at all.
When friends ask me about what I do in my spare time and I say I sit reading cricket books, friends who are into cricket are very interested in that, and they, you know, the conversation ticks happily along. Friends who aren't into cricket at all say to me, oh, what should I read and would I be interested in it? Right. And I often point them towards towards your books, because I think that there's simultaneously something in them that captures the detail of cricket so precisely, but yet also takes cricket beyond itself. I mean, it's the CLR, you know, James trope, of course. But who is your audience? Are you seeking to write to cricket for two and four cricket lovers, or for an audience that perhaps doesn't know and love cricket?
I like that Borges line about I write for myself and my friends and to pass the time. I've always just written with the sort of the ambition to amuse myself and interest myself and stretch myself at the same time. You know, do something that I haven't necessarily done before, to write in a different vein or to write on a different gauge. I can write quite nerdy stuff. I can write quite expansive stuff. I can interview players. I can. It is quite interesting the number of places that you can go as a cricket writer. Perhaps that would be the thing that you'd tell your friends, is that you know, when you write about cricket, you're not writing the same piece over and over again. You can go some quite eccentric places. For instance, one of the areas that I've become obsessed with over the last 10 or so years is the area of cricket governance,
yep,
which is a subject that on which very little, I can assure you, had been written and was actually very poorly understood. But I sort of sensed around about 2005 that it was going to become much, much more important as the game grew wealthier and as the game grew more kind of bureaucratized. So I sort of set myself to the task of resolving what were the major issues, who were the chief personalities, how the structures had evolved, what sort of external and internal pressures they were under. And it's been a gift that's kept on giving, that particular subject.
Yes, that was a prophetic moment in 2005, thinking that that might be something that would be important.
I've made some bad decisions in my time, but that was not one of them.
So that reminds me of, I'm going to do the thing that you should never do to authors, which is just read you one of your own, a quotation from one of your own things. And but I just thought this was an interesting run when I first read it, which was, I've written down somewhere, it's 2012, I think it was an address here in Melbourne, and you said, I tend to lean a little against prevailing points of view to try to move the terms of public debate along a bit. Now, clearly cricket administration is something that you feel needs to have public debate moved along in it. How do you see your responsibilities, actually, as a cricket writer, your responsibilities within the ecosystem of the game? What's your role? What should you be doing and trying to do?
Well, firstly, you should be independent and also prepared to go where other people aren't going. One of the besetting sins of journalism is that we tend to write for each other, that we all sort of fall on the same subject at the same time. And sometimes it can require a certain amount of courage to look the other way and say, oh, there's something actually more interesting happening over there that maybe you haven't noticed, and not to pay too much attention if other people don't necessarily follow in your footsteps. I know that, you know, one of the reasons why I've written about the BCCI quite a lot is because I know that Indian journalists find it really difficult to write about the BCCI when they are, you know, they can be...
Well, they're relying for press passes and they're relying for everything else.
Absolutely. So I've always felt a certain obligation to scrutinise what they're doing quite closely and to call it in as sceptical a fashion as I can.
And how far is that? We've talked a bit about your background in writing about business. When you're writing about administration and you're writing about the economics of the game and many other things, in some senses that's not really to do with cricket in the same way that you're writing about, you know, that wonderful description at the second part of, you know, on Warne, of how Warne bowls an over, that compared to an analysis of the BCCI are worlds apart. Do you feel a kind of sort of moral obligation towards the latter? Is that what makes you do it, or is it the interest in that side of the game per se?
Well, it's kind of both, isn't it? You know, you don't write about these things if they're not interesting to write about, and if you're not curious about them. Ultimately, Toby, it's just a game, really. You know, it's not like I'm writing about corruption in the halls of Whitehall or the White House. It's a game, and it's meant to be enjoyed. And it just occasionally just put your hand up and say, why are we doing it this way? And what are we doing it for? And what is this thing called cricket that we purport to love so much? But many of us rely on for our kind of livelihoods.
And do you feel like you're getting anywhere with that? Is the pen being mightier than the sword?
Well, certainly annoy people. if that's a measure of sort of journalistic success, I know I can be irritating.
Well, the pay dispute last year was quite an interesting one, actually, where when that came out into the public, that changed the dynamic around it, or seemed to change the dynamic around it quite considerably, perhaps.
How's that?
Well, just in the sense that when it was called out in the media, and it wasn't the kind of thing that Cricket Australia knew that they could just do quietly, it sort of pivoted the perspective around... How Cricket Australia had to act, because they've got a media arm they've got to keep happy, as well as some financial arms they've got to keep happy.
They seem to have very peculiar belief that they could just conduct it entirely behind closed doors, and that no one should even think of raising any sort of contrary comment about it. And I know that they weren't terribly happy with what I wrote, but I'm not writing to make them happy. It was... Yeah, I mean, for an organisation that has such a large media arm, they did a very, very
bad job of selling
their story. In fact, they really should have been selling their story for the 2 or 3 years preceding. They just seemed to think that they could do it in as kind of a cloak and dagger fashion. It wasn't to say that their argument was without merit, but they just did a very, very poor job of articulating it.
So we've got, you know, journalists who are... under fire from cricket boards around the world. We've got perhaps more so than ever, although I have no scientific data to back this up, writers who are writing for money, you know, the latest biography of whoever it is. You talked earlier about the fact that people who write books about cricket of the kind that you do are a small, small handful. Is cricket writing in crisis?
No, it's not in crisis. I mean, it's not important enough to be in crisis. That would be being melodramatic. It's certainly changing. One of the best things about cricket writing that's happened in my lifetime is that it's just so much more open and accessible. You know, when I started, it was a terribly, terribly closed shop, and it was it was some fairly monotonous and pretty institutionalized voices that seemed to exercise monopoly on cricket comment. Now, like yourself, you know, anyone can pull up a modem and pull up a keyboard and they can have their say. That produces a lot of dross, but occasionally it produces fantastic stuff, much, much better and more illuminating than anything that comes out of our allegedly professionalized clack.
I think you'll probably dismiss the premise of this question, but do you see yourself as not necessarily inheriting a mantle, but as being a part of a vein of cricket writing which is fundamentally literary and engaged in the game in a way that kind of, you know, Channel 9 journalists, dare I say, aren't? Because there do seem to be two different camps there, and you seem to sit squarely in one rather than in the other.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because I don't see myself that way at all. I don't see myself as particularly literary. I see myself as fundamentally journalistic. That's where I've learned my craft.
What do you mean by the difference between those two?
Well, I don't write like Neville Carras. I don't think I do. I don't sort of sit in the press box and write sort of impressionistic accounts of my surroundings that refer to Lancashire cricketers of the 1920s.
I suppose what I mean by literary is that the strength of what you do absolutely lies in your cricket knowledge, but it also lies in your ability to write, whereas for quite a lot of writers nowadays, actually the ability to write is secondary to the insight that you're getting in what happened in the dressing room on the last day of X and, you know, who's that with who.
I guess. I mean, there is a hinterland in my writing which comes from pretty wide reading that I have written about other subjects that I try as best I can to see cricket in its sort of social and cultural contexts, but I'm also pretty heavily involved in the current game, and I'm interested in the issues confronting it. I don't think an exceptionally backward looking writer, but I can kind of go both ways, and I'm interested in exploring the places that you can take cricket that haven't been written about before. I'm interested in kind of extending the canon, maybe, rather than necessarily following in the canon.
Are there projects on the boil that you can talk about, or are they things ruminating in the back of your head?
Well, the next book that I'm writing is not a cricket book at all. It's a true crime book that's coming out in about a month's time, and I'm sort of quite heavily in that headspace at the moment, and I'm interested in doing that book because it is a slightly different approach to true crime, which isn't, of course, germane to your podcast at all, but
we'd review anything written by you on our podcast, so. And that's about the woman in Melbourne.
It is, yeah.
Isn't it?
Scandal in Bohemia. Yeah. It's a book that I thought sort of emerged out of the last true crime, which I did, where I sort of, one of the things that occurred to me when I was reading through the representative works of certainly the Australian true crime canon, I was struck by how, by default, true crime tended to concentrate on perpetrators. And I sort of walked away from certain missions with the desire to write a true crime book from a victim's perspective. So that's what I've done in Scandal in Bohemia. I've written about a young, intelligent, creative, precocious young woman of the 1920s who moved in a sort of an artistic milieu and had the misfortune to meet with an untimely death, but led an interesting life and had an elaborately mythologized afterlife. So it sort of played to areas of inquiry and sort of forms of expression that I was interested in.
And in fact, when you give that little precy, that could be apply to so much if you're writing about the past, those issues of kind of myth and legend and how we come to perceive things many years later.
Well, I guess Stroke of Genius is in that vein as well. They're looking at one sort of very famous image and trying to sort of peel it of its various layers. But in the course of these books, you're always learning to write these books because those books don't already exist. You have to think, well, how do I do this book when there isn't sort of something readily available for comparison? Yeah. Sometimes you succeed more than others. Sometimes you get to the end of the book and you wish that you could start it again because now you know how to do it, or now you know how not to do it. So I'm not interested in repeating myself. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds strange if someone has written 22 cricket books, but I'm not interested in doing what I've already done. I guess I could have gone on writing books like Mystery Spinner. I could have gone on writing about melancholy, sensitive, brooding, self-destructive misfits.
Plenty of them in our game.
There were a lot of those, but I immediately, after doing Mystery Spinner, I immediately went and wrote about Warwick Armstrong, who was the antithesis of that. And I wanted to write about someone who was bluff and overbearing and contrary and ornery and unapologetic. So,
is it a coincidence that the and I am not certain whether this question is going to be factually true, but the only cricketer of let's say the modern generation to whom you have dedicated a book is Shane Warne, is that right? And yet there are plenty more of years, you know, of previous generations, and that's because obviously there have been more cricketers in previous generations than there have been in the present generation. Do you see there being players on the, I'm not necessarily asking for specific names, but players on the scene today who have as who could potentially be material enough for a book like on Warne?
It's interesting. Well, I only did one Warne because I was asked to do it, frankly. It was such an obvious subject that, of course, it never occurred to me to write a book about Shane Warne. A publisher said, have you ever considered writing a book about Shane Warne? I went, no, but that's quite an interesting idea.
No, but I'll do it, yeah.
And I think I could find a different way to do that. It's very possible to write 100 versions of the same book about Shane Warne, but I wanted to find a different way to do it, and I thought, I also thought I needed to do it in the right spirit, which is that I should enjoy very much writing a book about Shane Warne because it was terribly enjoyable to watch him. I should write it quickly, I should write it spontaneously, without too much premeditation. I should simply kind of transcribe the thoughts that have been swimming around in my own head. So that's the way that I did Warne. I tried to write a book about Warne in a Warne-esque kind of way, even though, of course, Shane Warne and I, very dissimilar individuals, and you know, but the thing that we have in common is a deep and abiding love of cricket. I don't doubt it in Shane Warne's case, and I certainly don't doubt it in mine. I think I'd need, if I was to write in a similar way about a contemporary cricketer, I'd need to find a different way to do it. I don't think I'd be interested in writing a conventional biographer of a contemporary player. I think because their careers are so monotonous now.
Yeah.
I think I'd have to find a way to step back or to mediate the experience in some unusual way. I had an interesting conversation with Ed last week about a potential project. And I've considered how best to write about cricket now. Because I think we're actually lacking a book that tells the story of cricket now from the inside. Certainly, in the way that you know, players used to write tour diaries. They used to write autobiographies that sort of followed their careers sequentially. But now there's so many different ways to lead a career. I'm still looking for the player or the player's story that can do justice to the way in which the game has changed.
So that was the 100th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. It's taken us 7 years and 4 months. And as we raise our bats to all four corners of the ground, of course, none of this would have happened without the support that we would have had from you, the listeners. So thank you for that. It's been quite a journey. When we discovered that we had set up a Gmail account and that there were some nice emails in there, that was one of the things that fairly early on kicked us into making this serious, as well as the feedback that we've had on Twitter. And then, of course, the old iTunes reviews, all of those do spur us on. They're also very helpful for other people in finding us. So if you like what you've heard, or even if you don't like what you've heard, frankly, please go onto one of those forums and either praise or rant. We fully intend to on into the hundreds, to make this into a daddy hundred, as they said. We hope you'll join us for that journey.